stayed behind, urging the people back to the train. "Well, it's a rum go," said the station master. It was certainly a rum go as far as I was concerned. "What happened, Stephen?" I asked under my breath. Rose suddenly raised her head and whispered fiercely, "Shut up! Get the trunks off the train!" Then, as Neil was carrying her carefully down the little embankment, I heard her tell them they could get out through the field at the back of the station. He crossed the line with her and went straight into it. They never went back to the station at all. Stephen lit them with a lantern for a minute or two, then joined me in the guard's van. Before I could get a word out, he said, "Please, please don't ask me any questions yet, Miss Cassandra." I was throwing the beaver coat and the rug and the jacket out onto the platform. "Well, at least you can tell me where the bear coat is," I began. But just then the guard came back. Poor man, he couldn't make out how the bear had got out of the van. I told him Rose had been in there when Neil Cotton slammed the doors and had opened the far side doors when she heard the bear growling. "It was after her like a streak," I said. That seemed to clear things up nicely. The station master helped us to get the trunks onto Mr. Stebbins' cart. The Cotton's car was only a few yards away, and there was Rose inside it, talking to Mrs. Cotton. Simon Cotton came out of the station and said to me, "We're driving your sister home. Will you come too?" But I said I would stay with Stephen. It was partly embarrassment and partly that I was afraid I should say the wrong thing, not having the faintest idea what had really happened. And I couldn't get anything out of Stephen on the way home. All he would say was, "Oh, it was dreadful, dreadful. Miss Rose had better tell you herself. I'm saying nothing." I had to wait until she and I were in bed last night for anything like the whole story. Oh, she gave us all a brief outline as soon as she got home, but I guessed she was holding things back. All she told us then was that Neil Cotton came rushing at her with the pitchfork. She screamed, and then suddenly he got the hang of things and told Simon and Stephen to pretend there really had been a bear. Neil and Simon even pretended it to their mother, she said. Oh, they were marvellous. I never heard Father laugh so much. He said the story would be built up and embroidered on until Rose had been pursued by a herd of stampeding elephants, and he was greatly impressed by the Cottons' quick-mindedness. They hadn't come in, just left Rose in the courtyard. Neil said they'd leave me to tell my story in my own way, she said, and now I've told it, and you'll all have to pretend there was really a bear for ever and ever. She was ablaze with excitement, not in the least upset at having been so conspicuous. It was I who was upset. I don't know why. Perhaps I was just overtired. I suddenly began to shiver and wanted to cry. Topaz hurried us to bed and brought us cocoa and hot bricks for our feet, and I soon felt better. She kissed us in a motherly way that Rose doesn't appreciate and told us not to talk too long. I think she wanted to stay and talk herself, but Father yelled for her to come along to bed. "Let's finish our cocoa in the dark," I said, and blew out the candle. Rose is always more confidential in the dark. The first thing she said was, "How much did Stephen tell you on the way home?" I told her how he had said it was too dreadful to tell. "I wondered if he'd seen," she said. Then she began to giggle, the first time for months. The giggles became muffled, and I guess she was stifling them in her pillow. At last she came up for air and said, "I slapped Neil Cotton's face." "Rose!" I gasped. "Why?" She said she had looked round and seen him coming, seen the pitchfork against the sky, and let out the scream we heard. Then I tried to get out of the coat, but I couldn't find the buttons, so I went on running. He yelled, "Stop! Stop!" He must have seen by then that I wasn't really a bear. Then he caught up with me and grabbed me by the arm. I said, "Let go, damn you!" And Stephen heard my voice and called out, "It's Miss Rose!" Neil Cotton shouted, "But why are you running away?" And I said, "Because I don't want to meet you or your brother either. You can both go to hell." And I hit him across the face. "Oh, Rose!" I felt all knotted up by the awfulness of it. "What did he say?" "He said, 'Good God!' And then Simon and Stephen came up, and Stephen said all the people on the train were out after me. 'That's your fault,' I said to Neil Cotton. 'You've made me the laughingstock of the neighbourhood.' And he said, 'Wait, be quiet. And then he told them to pretend there really had been a bear, as I told you. Don't you think it was wonderfully kind of him? I asked. She said, yes, in a way, then stopped. And I knew she was trying to work out something in her mind. At last she went on, but it's all part of his not taking us seriously. Not just us, but England generally. He wouldn't have dared to pretend anything so silly in America, I bet. He thinks England's a joke, a funny sort of toy. Toy trains, toy countryside. I could tell that by the way he talked coming home in the car. I knew what she meant. I had felt it a bit that night they first came to the castle. Not with Simon, though. And I'm sure Neil doesn't mean it unkindly. I asked what the mother was like. Beautiful, and never stops talking. Father'll want to brain her with a brick. If he ever meets her. He'll meet her all right. We shall be seeing quite a lot of the Cottons now. Her tone was so confident, almost arrogant, that I was frightened for her. Oh, Rose, don't be silly with them this time. I said it before I could stop myself. She simply pounced on it. What do you mean, silly? Did Topaz say I was? I said I was merely guessing, but she wouldn't leave it at that. She battered at me with questions. What with wanting to defend Topaz and being very tired, I wasn't as strong-minded as I ought to have been, and Topaz had said it might be best to tell her if we got another chance with the Cottons. But I felt perfectly dreadful when I had told. Mean, both to the Cottons and Rose. Still, if it does her any good... And I was careful to stress about my being consciously naive. I left out the bit about Father. She wanted to know which brother had said the worst things. I sorted the remarks out as best I could. Well, at least Simon was sorry for me, she said. It was Neil who suggested dropping us. Oh, how I'll pay them out. Don't count it against them, I begged. Look how very kind they were tonight. And if you're sure they want to be friends now... I'm sure, all right. Did they say anything about seeing us again? Never mind what they said. And then, to my surprise, she started to giggle again. She wouldn't tell me why. When she stopped, she said she was sleepy. I tried to keep her talking by being Miss Blossom. Here, Rosie, have you got something up your sleeve, you naughty girl? But she wasn't having any. If I have, it's staying there, she said. You and Miss Blossom go to sleep. But I lay awake for ages going over it all. Heavens, God's End Church clock has just struck four. I have been writing up here on the mound for 6 hours. Topaz never rang the lunch bell for me. Instead, she brought me out some milk and 2 big cheese sandwiches and a message from Father that I was to write as long as I liked. It seems selfish when the others are working hard on Aunt Millicent's clothes. But while we were unpacking them this morning, I began to shake again, and when Topaz found out what I felt about them, she said I had better write it out of my system. I think I have, because I can now look down on them flapping on the line without any horror. Though I don't feel fond of them yet, as I do of the furs. Stephen cycled to Scotney Station before he went to work and brought back the bear coat. It was hidden in a ditch. Father can remember hearing about this coat when he was little. He says most coachmen were lucky if they got a short goatskin cape to wear in winter, but great-grandmother said that if her husband, who rode inside the carriage, had a beaver-lined coat, the coachman out in the cold ought to be at least as warmly dressed. He was grateful for the bear coat, but embarrassed, as little boys used to jeer and ask him to dance. The sealskin jacket was Aunt Millicent's in the '90s, before she turned against furs. Father thinks she kept all these out of family sentiment, and perhaps because she was only happy as a child. How queer to think that the old lady in the black military cloak was the Miss Millie who went to the dancing class. It makes me wonder what I shall be like when I am old. My hand is very tired, but I want to go on writing. I keep resting and thinking. All day I have been two people, the me imprisoned in yesterday and the me out here on the mound. And now there is a third me trying to get in, the me in what is going to happen next. Will the Cottons ask us to Scotney? Topaz thinks they will. She says the oddness of the bear incident will fascinate them, just as they were fascinated by the oddness of the first night they came to the castle, and that Rose running away will have undone the damage she did by being too forthcoming. If only she doesn't forthcome again. Topaz approves of my telling her last night. She had a talk with her herself about it this morning, and Rose listened with surprising civility. Just be rather quiet, and do a lot of listening until you feel at ease, Topaz advised her. And for pity's sake, don't be challenging. Your looks will do the challenging if you give them the chance. I do love Topaz when she is in a down-to-earth mood. Is it awful to join in this planning? Is it trying to sell one's sister? But surely Rose can manage to fall in love with them. I mean, with whichever one will fall in love with her. I hope it will be Neil, because I really do think Simon is a little frightening. Only it is Neil who thinks England is a joke. I have been resting, just staring down at the castle. I wish I could find words, serious, beautiful words, to describe it in the afternoon sunlight. The more I strive for them, the more they utterly elude me. How can one capture the pool of light in the courtyard? The golden windows, the strange long-ago look, the look that one sees in old paintings. I can only think of the light of other days, and I didn't make that up. Oh, I have just seen the Cottons' car on the God's End Road, near the high crossroads, where one gets the first glimpse of the castle. They're coming here. Do I watch and wait again? No fear. I am going down. Chapter 7. We are asked to Scotney, to dinner, a week from today. And there is something else I want to write about, something belonging to me. Oh, I don't know where to begin. I got down from Belmont in time to warn the others. Rose and Topaz were ironing, and Rose put on a clean blouse, hot from the iron. Topaz just tidied herself and then set the tea tray. I washed, and then reckoned I had only enough time either to warn Father or to brush my hair. But I managed to do both by taking the comb and brush to the gatehouse with me. Father jumped up so quickly that I feared he was going to rush out to avoid the Cottons, but he merely grabbed my hairbrush and brushed his coat with it. Neither of us felt it was a moment for fussiness. In the end, we had a few minutes to spare because they left the car at the end of the lane. The mud is dry now, but the ruts are still deep. "Mrs. Cotton's with them," I cried as they came round the last bend of the lane. Father said he would meet them at the gatehouse arch. "It's not going to be my fault if anything goes wrong this time. I've promised Topaz." Then he looked a bit grim and added, "I'm glad you're still on the young side to be marketed." I bolted back to Rose and Topaz. They had lit a wood fire in the drawing-room and arranged some daffodils. The fire made the room feel more spring-like than ever. We opened the windows and the swans sailed by, looking mildly interested. Suddenly I remembered that first spring afternoon in the drawing-room, with Rose playing her piece. I saw Mother leaning out over the moat. I saw her grey dress so clearly, though I still couldn't see her face. Something inside me said, "Oh, Mother, make the right thing happen for Rose." And I had a vision of poor Mother scurrying from heaven to do the best she could. The way one's mind can dash about just while one opens a window. Then Father came in with the Cottons. Rose thought Mrs. Cotton beautiful, but that isn't how I would describe her. Topaz is beautiful, largely because of the strangeness of her face. That look she has of belonging to a whiter-than-white race. Rose, with her lovely colouring and her eyes that can light up her whole expression, is beautiful. Mrs. Cotton is handsome. No, that makes her sound too big. She is just wonderfully good-looking. Wonderfully right-looking. She has exactly the right amount of colour. Her black hair is going grey without looking streaky because it has exactly the right number of grey hairs in exactly the right places, and it has exactly the right amount of wave. Her figure is perfect, and so were her clothes. Just country tweeds, but so much more exciting than I ever thought tweeds could be. They had clear colours in them, shades of blue which made you notice her eyes. I rather fear that I stared too hard at her. I hope she realised that it was only admiration. As she is Simon Cotton's mother, she can't be much less than 50, which is hard to believe. Yet now I come to think of it, I can't imagine her being any younger. It is just that she is a different kind of 50 from any I have ever seen. She came in talking solidly. And solidly is a very good word to describe it. It made me think of a wall of talk. Fortunately, she speaks beautifully, just as Simon does, and she doesn't in the least mind being interrupted. Her sons do it all the time, and father soon acquired the technique. It was him she talked to most. After he had introduced Topaz and me, and she had shaken hands with us all, and hoped Rose had recovered from her shock, and said, "Will you look at those swans?" She started on Jacob wrestling and how she had heard father lecture in America. They went on, interrupting each other in a perfectly friendly manner. Rose sat on the window seat and talked to Simon, and Topaz and I slipped out to bring the tea in. Neil kindly came after us, saying he would carry things. We stood round the kitchen fire waiting for the kettle to boil. "Doesn't your mother really know Rose was the bear?" I asked. "Gosh, no. That wouldn't do at all," he said. "It isn't her kind of joke. Anyway, it wouldn't be fair to your sister." I did see that, of course. Mrs. Cotton would have wondered why on earth Rose was running away. I suppose Neil guesses it was because she felt they had dropped us. Dear me, how embarrassing. "But I can't see how anyone could believe that you killed the bear with a pitchfork," I said. "I didn't. I only wounded it, badly, I think. But not enough to put it out of action. It came blundering towards me, I stepped aside, and it crashed headfirst into the river. I could hear it threshing about in the darkness. I picked up a big stone. Poor brute. I hated to do it, but I had to finish it off. It gave just one groan as the stone hit it, and then went down. I held the lantern high. I could see the bubbles coming up, and then I saw the dark bulk of it under the water, being carried along by the current."
"But you didn't have a lantern," I said.
"He didn't have a bear," said Topaz. For a moment, I had almost believed him myself, and felt most desperately sorry for the bear. No wonder Mrs. Cotton has been deceived. "Mother made us go over to compensate the circus owner this morning," he went on, grinning. "It's just a midget of a circus. He didn't have any bears at all, as a matter of fact. But he said he'd be delighted to back our story up. He hoped it might get him a bit of publicity. I tried to buy one of his lions, but he wouldn't sell."
"What did you want a lion for?" I asked.
"Oh, they were kind of cute," he said vaguely. Then the kettle boiled, and we took the tea in. After Neil had helped to hand things round, he went and sat by Rose at the window seat, and Simon came and talked to Topaz politely. Father and Mrs. Cotton were still interrupting each other happily. It was fascinating to watch them all, but the conversations cancelled each other out so that I couldn't listen to any of them. I was anxious about Rose. I could see she was letting Neil do most of the talking, which was excellent, but she didn't seem to be listening to him, which was not so good. She kept leaning out of the window to feed the swans. Neil looked a bit puzzled. Then I noticed that Simon kept watching her, and after a while she caught his eye and gave him a smile. Neil shot a quick glance at her, then got up and asked Topaz for some more tea, though I noticed he didn't drink it. Simon went over to Rose. She still didn't say much, but she looked as if everything he said was terrifically interesting. I caught a word here and there. He was telling her about Scotney Hall. I heard her say, "No, I've never seen the inside," he said. "But you must, of course. We were hoping you'd dine with us one night next week." Then he turned to Mrs. Cotton, and she invited us. There was an awful moment when I thought I was going to be left out, because she said, "Is Cassandra old enough for dinner parties?" But Neil said, "You bet she is," and it was all right. Oh, I do like Neil. When they went, I walked up the lane with him. Father was with Mrs. Cotton, and Rose with Simon. Neil asked how he would get over to Scotney, and when I said we should have to think that out, he arranged to send a car for us. He is the kindest person, though as we passed the barn I remembered how very far from kind he was about Rose that day. Perhaps one ought never to count things one overhears. Anyway, it was Simon who said I was consciously naive. Neil said I was a cute kid. It's not exactly the way I see myself, but it was kindly meant. As we walked back to the castle, Father said how nice they all were, then asked if we had dresses for the party. I had been worrying about this myself, but I said, "Oh, Topaz will manage something." "Could anything of Aunt Millicent's be altered?" "If not, damn it, there must be something we can sell." He gave me a humble, appealing sort of look. I put my arm through his and said quickly, "We'll be all right." He looked tentatively at Rose. She was smiling faintly to herself, I don't think she had heard a word we had said. When we went in, Topaz was washing up the tea things.
Mortmain, you deserve a medal, she said.
What for? Said Father. Oh, for talking to Mrs. Cotton. I enjoyed it very much. Topaz simply stared at him.
I got used to the vitality of American women when I was over there, he explained.
Do they all talk as much as that? I asked.
No, of course not. But she happens to belong to a type I frequently met. It goes to lectures and entertains afterwards. Sometimes they put one up for the night. They're extraordinarily hospitable.
He sat on the kitchen table, swinging his legs, looking rather boyish.
Amazing, their energy, he went on. They're perfectly capable of having three or four children, running a house, keeping abreast of art, literature and music. Superficially, of course, but good Lord, that's something. And holding down a job into the bargain. Some of them get through two or three husbands as well, just to avoid stagnation.
I shouldn't think any husband could stay the course for more than a few years, said Topaz.
I felt that myself at first. The barrage of talk left me utterly depleted. But after a time, I got used to it. They're rather like punch balls. You buffet them. They buffet you, and on the whole, the result's most stimulating.
Unless they knock you out altogether, said Topaz dryly.
They have that effect occasionally, Father admitted. Quite a number of American men are remarkably silent.
She seemed to know a lot about Jacob wrestling, I said.
She'd probably read it up before she came, they do that, and very several of them. Curious how many of them are prematurely grey, most becoming. And I must say, it's a pleasure to see a woman so well turned out.
He began to hum abstractedly and went off to the gatehouse as if he had suddenly forgotten all about us. I could have slapped him for that well-turned-out remark because Topaz was looking so particularly far from well-turned-out. She was wearing her hand-woven dress, which is first cousin to a sack, and her lovely hair, being rather in need of a wash, was pushed into a torn old net.
Perhaps he'd find it stimulating if I talked as much as that, she said.
We shouldn't, I told her.
Actually, I had thought Mrs. Cotton very stimulating myself, but had no intention of being so tactless as to say so.
Topaz, will there be moths in his evening clothes? He can't have worn them since Aunt Millicent's parties.
But she said she had taken care of them.
We'll have to get him some studs, though, because he sold his good ones.
Oh, Cassandra, it's fantastic. A genius. A man American critics write essays on, and he hasn't a decent stud to his name.
I said many geniuses had lacked the shirts to put the studs in. Then we got talking about our own clothes for the party.
I'm all right. My white school speech day frock will pass for anyone as young as I am, Topaz says, and she can fix up one of her old evening dresses for herself.
Rose is the problem.
There's not a thing of your aunt's I can use for her, said Topaz, and nothing of my own is suitable. She needs something frilly. As we'll never be able to stop her turning on the early Victorian charm, we ought to accentuate it.
I could hear Rose playing the piano. I closed the kitchen door and said, "What did you think of her manner today?"
At least it was quieter, though she was still making eyes. But anyway, it doesn't matter now.
I looked at her in astonishment, and she went on,
"Simon Cotton's attracted, really attracted. Couldn't you see? Once that happens, a girl can be as silly as she likes. The man will probably think the silliness is fetching.
Is Neil attracted too?
I doubt it, said Topaz. I've an idea that Neil sees through her. I saw him give her a very shrewd look.
Oh, how are we going to dress her, Cassandra? There's a chance for her with Simon, really there is. I know the signs.
I had a sudden picture of Simon's face, pale above the beard.
But would you really like her to marry him, Topaz? I asked.
I'd like her to get the chance, said Topaz firmly.
Miss Marcy arrived with a book for Father. She told us the vicar has been invited for the same night as we have. She'd heard it from his housekeeper.
Most people have only been asked to lunches or teas, she said. Dinner's ever so much more splendid.
We told her about the problem of Rose's dress.
It should be pink, she said. A crinoline effect. There's the very thing here in this week's home chat.
She dived into her satchel for it.
Oh, dear, that would be perfect for her, sighed Topaz. Miss Marcy blushed and blinked her eyes, then said,
"Could you make it, Mrs. Mortmain?
If dear Rose allowed me to give her the material."
"I'll allow you," said Topaz.
"I feel justified." Miss Marcy shot her a quick glance, and Topaz gave her the very faintest nod. I nearly laughed. They were so different. Miss Marcy like a rosy little bird, and Topaz tall and pale, like a slightly dead goddess. But just that second, they so much resembled each other in their absolute lust to marry Rose off.
"Perhaps we could offer Miss Marcy something of Aunt Millicent's as a small return," I suggested. They went off to the dining room where the clothes were spread out, while I stayed to get Steve and his tea.
Topaz had decided that those of us who had had afternoon tea would have supper with Coco later. Stephen was worried to hear I should be wearing such an old dress at Scotney.
"Couldn't you have a new sash?" he asked. "I've got some money saved."
I thanked him, but said my blue speech day sash was as good as new.
"Then a ribbon for your hair, Miss Cassandra." "Goodness, I haven't worn a hair ribbon since I was a child," I told him.
"You used to have little bows on the end of your plaits before you cut your hair," he said. "They were pretty." Then he asked how I liked the two cottons. Now I knew them better.
"Oh, I don't know Simon at all. He talked to Rose most of the time, but Neil's very nice."
"Would you call him handsome?"
I said I hardly thought so.
"Not really handsome. Not the way you are, Stephen."
I spoke without thinking. We all of us take his good looks for granted. But he blushed so much that I wished I hadn't said it.
"You see, you have classical features," I explained in a matter-of-fact voice.
"It seems a waste when I'm not a gentleman," he grinned, a little sarcastic sort of grin.
"Don't talk like that," I said quickly. "Gentlemen are men who behave like gentlemen, and you certainly do." He shook his head.
"You can only be a gentleman if you're born one, Miss Cassandra."
"Stephen, that's old-fashioned nonsense," I said.
"Really it is. And, by the way, will you please stop calling me Miss Cassandra?"
He looked astonished. Then he said,
"Yes, I see. It should be Miss Mortmain, now you've grown up enough for dinner parties."
"It certainly shouldn't," I said. "I mean, you must call me Cassandra, without the Miss. You're one of the family. It's absurd you should ever have called me Miss. Who told you to?"
"My mother. She set a lot of store by it," he said. "I remember the first day we came here. You and Miss Rose were throwing a ball in the garden and I ran to the kitchen door thinking I'd play too. Mother called me back and told me how you were young ladies and I was never to play with you unless I was invited and to call you Miss and never to presume. She had a hard job explaining what presume meant."
"Oh, Stephen, how awful. And you'd be how old?"
7, I think."
"You'd be 6.
And Miss Rose 9. Thomas was only 4, but she told me to call him Master Thomas. Only he asked me not 2 years ago."
"And I ought to have asked you years ago. I'd never given it a thought."
His mother had been in service for years before she married. When she was left a widow, she had to go back to it and board Stephen out. I know she was very grateful when Mother let her bring him here, so perhaps that made her extra humble. "Well, anyway, I've asked you now," I went on. "So will you please remember?"
"Would I call Miss Rose just Rose?" he asked.
I wasn't sure how Rose would feel about it, so I said, "Oh, why worry about Rose? This is between you and me."
"I couldn't call her Miss and not you," he said firmly. "It'd be setting her above you."
I said I would talk to Rose about it, then asked him to pass his cup for more tea. I was getting a bit embarrassed by the subject. He stirred his second cup for a long time, then said,
"Did you mean that about gentlemen being men who behave like gentlemen?"
"Of course I did, Stephen. I swear I did. Really." I was so anxious to make him believe me that I leaned towards him across the table. He looked at me. Right into my eyes. That queer, veiled expression in his, that I fear I used to call his daft look, was suddenly not there. There seemed to be a light in them, and yet I've never seen them look so dark. And they were so direct that it was more like being touched than being looked at. It only lasted a second.
But for that second he was quite a different person, much more interesting. Even a little bit exciting. Then Thomas came in, and I jumped up from the table. "Why are you so red in the face, my girl?" he said maddeningly. I do understand why Rose sometimes wants to hit him. Fortunately, he didn't wait for an answer, but went on to say there was a bit in the King's Crypt paper about the bear being washed up 20 miles away. I laughed and put an egg on to boil for him. Stephen went out into the garden. All the time I was giving Thomas his tea, I was worrying, because I suddenly knew I couldn't go on pretending that Stephen is just vaguely devoted to me and it doesn't in the least matter. I hadn't given it a thought for weeks, and I certainly hadn't been brisk with him as Father had suggested. I told myself I would start at once. And then I felt I couldn't, not after I'd just asked him to stop calling me Miss. Incidentally, I never felt less brisk in my life because being looked at like that makes a person feel dizzy. I went into the garden to think things out. It was that time of evening when pale flowers look paler. The daffodils seemed almost white. They were very still. Everything was still. Hushed. Father's lamp was lit in the gatehouse. Topaz and Miss Marcy had a candle in the dining room. Rose was still playing the piano in the drawing room without a light. I'd stopped feeling dizzy. I had a strange, excited feeling. I went through the gatehouse passage out into the lane and walked past the barn. Stephen came out. He didn't smile as he usually does when he sees me. He looked at me with a kind of questioning expression. Then he said, "Let's go for a little walk." I said, "All right." And then, "No, I don't think I will, Stephen. I want to see Miss Marcy again before she goes." I didn't want to see Miss Marcy in the least. I wanted to go for the walk, but I suddenly knew I mustn't. Stephen just nodded. Then we went back to the castle together without saying a word to each other. When Rose and I were going to bed, I asked her if she would mind Stephen dropping the miss. "I don't mind one way or the other," she said. "After all, I'm eating the food he pays for." I started to talk about the cottons then, but she wouldn't be jolly or excited about them. She seemed to want to think. And I did some quiet thinking myself. Early this morning, I met Stephen letting out the hens and told him Rose would like him to stop saying miss. I was splendidly brisk. It's easy to be brisk in the early morning. He just said, "All right," without very much expression. Over breakfast, Rose and Topaz were planning to go to King's Crypt to buy the stuff for Rose's dress. They are there now. I have had most of the day to myself. I was at the fire making toast. Stephen came over to me. "Please let me ask Mrs. Mortmain to get you something for the party," he said. I thanked him, but said I didn't need a thing. "You're sure?" Then he added very softly, and as if he were trying out some difficult word, "Cassandra." We both blushed. I had thought that dropping the miss for Rose as well would make it quite ordinary, but it didn't. "Goodness, this fire's hot," I said. "No, honestly, I can't think of anything I want." "Then I'll just go on saving up for what I was saving up for," he said, and then went off to work. It is now 4 o'clock. Father has gone to call on the vicar, so I have the castle to myself. It's odd how different a house feels when one is alone in it. It makes it easier to think rather private thoughts. I shall think some. I didn't get very far with my thoughts. It is the still, yellow kind of afternoon when one is apt to get stuck in a dream if one sits very quiet. I have been staring blankly at the bright square of the kitchen window for a good 10 minutes. I shall pull myself together and do some honest thinking. I have thought, and I have discovered the following things. 1. I do not reciprocate Stephen's feelings. 2. I wanted to go that walk with him yesterday evening, and, having always loathed girls in books who are too innocent, I set it on record. I think I thought that if I did go, he would kiss me. 3. This morning, by the hen house, I did not wish him to kiss me. 4. This moment, I do not think I wish him to kiss me.
I have thought some more. I have been stuck in the unblank kind of dream. I relived the minute when Stephen looked at me across the table. Even to remember it made me feel dizzy. I liked feeling dizzy. Then, in my mind, I went for the walk with him that I didn't go. We went along the lane over the God's End Road and into the little larch wood. There are no bluebells there yet, but I put them in. It was nearly dark in the wood and suddenly cool, cold. There was a waiting feeling. I made up things for Stephen to say. I heard his voice saying them. It got darker and darker until there was only the palest gleam of sky through the tops of the trees. And at last, he kissed me. But I couldn't make that up at all. I just couldn't imagine how it would feel. And I suddenly wished I hadn't imagined any of it. I am finishing this in the bedroom because I heard Stephen washing at the garden pump and dashed upstairs. I have just looked down on him from the window and I feel most guilty about taking him for that walk in my mind. Guilty and ashamed. With a weak feeling round my ribs. I won't do that sort of imagining again. And I am now quite certain I don't want him to kiss me. He does look extremely handsome there by the pump. But the daft look is back again. Oh, poor Stephen. I am a beast, isn't really daft. Though he certainly couldn't have thought of all those things I made him say. Some of them were rather good. I won't think about it any more. My spare time pleasure thinking shall be about the party at Scotney, which is really much more interesting. Though perhaps more interesting for Rose than for me. I wonder what it would be like to be kissed by either of the Cottons. No! I am not going to imagine that. Really, I'm shocked at myself. And anyway, there isn't time. Rose and Topaz are due back. I should rather like to tear these last pages out of the book, shall I? No, a journal ought not to cheat. And I feel sure no one but me can read my speed writing. But I shall hide the book. I always lock it up in my school attaché case, and this time I shall take the case out to Belmont Tower. I have a special place for hiding things there that not even Rose knows of. I shall go through the front door to avoid meeting Stephen. I really don't know how I can look him in the face after borrowing him as I have done. I will be brisk with him in future. I swear I will. Chapter 8. I shall have to do the evening at Scotney bit by bit, for I know I shall be interrupted. I shall want to be, really, because life is too exciting to sit still for long. On top of the Cottons appearing to like us, we have actually come by £20, the vicar having bought the rug that looks like a collie dog. Tomorrow we are going shopping in King's Crypt. I am to have a summer dress. Oh, it is wonderful to wake up in the morning with things to look forward to. Now, about Scotney. All week we were getting ready for the party. Topaz bought yards and yards of pink muslin for Rose's frock and made it most beautifully. At one time, before she was an artist model, Topaz worked at a great dressmaker's. But she will never tell us about it, or about any of her pasts, which always surprises me, because she is so frank about many things. Rose had a real crinoline to wear under the dress. Only a small one, but it made all the difference. We borrowed it from Mr. Stebbins' grandmother, who is 92. When the dress was finished, he brought her over to see Rose in it, and she told us she had worn the crinoline at her wedding in God's End Church when she was 16. I thought of Waller's Go Lovely Rose. How small a part of time they share that are so wondrous, sweet and fair. Though I refrained from mentioning it, the poor old lady was crying enough without that, but she said she had enjoyed the outing. It was fun while we were all sewing the frills for the dress. I kept pretending we were in a Victorian novel. Rose was fairly willing to play, but she always shut up if I brought the Cottons into the game. And we had no nice friendly candlelight conversations about them. She wasn't cross or sulky. She just seemed preoccupied, given to lying in bed not even reading, with a faint smirk on her face. Now I come to think of it, I was just as secretive about myself and Stephen. It would have embarrassed me dreadfully to tell her about my feelings. But then I have always been more secretive than she usually is. And I know that she thinks of him as
Well, as a boy of a different class from ours. Do I think it too? If so, I am ashamed of such snobbishness. I'm thankful to be able to record that I have been brisk, though perhaps it would be truer to say that I haven't been unbrisk. Except for that second last night when I took his hand. But that is part of the evening at Scotney Hall. It was thrilling when we started to get dressed. There was still some daylight left, but we drew the curtains and brought up the lamp and lit the candles because I once read that women of fashion dress for candlelight by candlelight. Our frocks were laid out on the four-poster. Mine had been washed, and Topaz had cut the neck down a bit. Miss Blossom was ecstatic about roses. She said, "My word, that'll fetch the gentleman. And I never knew you had such white shoulders. Fancy God giving you that hair but no freckles." Rose laughed, but she was cross because she couldn't see herself full length. Our long-looking glass got sold. I held our small one so that she could look at herself in sections, but it was tantalising for her. "There's the glass over the drawing-room fireplace," I said. "Perhaps if you stood on the piano." She went down to try. Father came from the bathroom and went through to his bedroom. The next second I heard him shout, "Good God, what have you done to yourself?" He sounded so horrified that I thought Topaz had had some accident. I dashed into Buffer State but stopped myself outside their bedroom door. I could see her from there. She was wearing a black evening dress that she never has liked herself in, a very conventional dress. Her hair was done up in a bun, and she had makeup on. Not much, just a little rouge and lipstick. The result was astounding. She looked quite ordinary. Just vaguely pretty, but not worth a second glance. Neither of them saw me. I heard her say, "Oh, Maud Maine, this is Rose's night. I want all the attention to be focused on her." I tiptoed back to the bedroom. I was bewildered at such unselfishness, particularly as she had spent hours mending her best evening dress. I knew what she meant, of course. At her most striking, she can make Rose's beauty look like mere prettiness. Suddenly I remembered that first night the Cottons came here, how she tried to efface herself. Oh, noble Topaz. I heard Father shout, "To hell with that! God knows I've very little left to be proud of. At least let me be proud of my wife." There was a throaty gasp from Topaz. "Oh, my darling." And then I hastily went downstairs and kept Rose talking in the drawing room. I felt this was something we oughtn't to be in on. And I felt embarrassed. I always do when I really think of Father and Topaz being married. When they came down, Topaz was as white as usual, and her silvery hair, which was at its very cleanest, was hanging down her back. She had her best dress on, which is Grecian in shape, like a clinging grey cloud, with a great grey scarf which she had draped round her head and shoulders. She looked most beautiful, and just how I imagined the angel of death. The Cottons' car came, with a uniformed chauffeur, and out we sailed. I was harrowed at leaving Stephen and Thomas behind, but Topaz had arranged they should have a supper with consoling sausages. It was a huge, wonderful car. We none of us talked very much in it. Personally, I was too conscious of the chauffeur. He was so rigid and correct, and had such outstanding ears. I just sat back, watching the darkening fields drift past, feeling rather frail and luxurious. And I thought about us all and wondered how the others were feeling. Father looked very handsome in his evening clothes, and he was kind and smiling, but I could see he was nervous. At least I thought I could. But then it struck me how little I know of him, or of Topaz, or Rose, or anyone in the world, really, except myself. I used to flatter myself that I could get flashes of what people were thinking, but if I did, it was only of quick surface thoughts. All these years, and I don't know what has stopped Father working. And I don't really know what Rose feels about the Cottons. As for Topaz, but I never did get any flashes of knowing her. Of course, I have always realised that she is kind, but I should never have thought her capable of making that noble sacrifice for Rose. And just as I was feeling ashamed of ever having thought her bogus, she said in a voice like plum cake, "Look, Maud Maine, look. Oh, don't you long to be an old, old man in a lamp-lit inn?" "Yes," Particularly one with rheumatism, said Father. My dear, you are an ass. We called for the vicar, which made it rather a squash, what with Rose's crinoline. He is the nicest man, about 50, plump, with curly golden hair, rather like an elderly baby, and most unholy. Father once said to him, God knows how you came to be a clergyman, and the vicar said, Well, it's his business to know. After he had had a look at us, he said, Mortmain, your women are spectacular. I'm not, I said. Ah, but you're the insidious type. Jane Eyre with a touch of Becky Sharp. A thoroughly dangerous girl. I like your string of coral. Then he got us all talking, and even made the chauffeur laugh. The odd thing is that he makes people laugh without saying anything very funny. I suppose it's because he is such a comfortable sort of man. It was dark when we got to Scotney Hall, and all the windows were lit up. There is a right of way through the park, and I had often cycled there on my way home from school, so I knew what the outside of the house was like. It is 16th century, except for the 17th century pavilion in the water garden. But I was longing to see inside. We went up shallow steps that had been worn into a deep curve, and the front door was opened before we had time to ring the bell. I had never met a butler before, and he made me feel self-conscious. But the vicar knew him and said something normal to him. We left our wraps in the hall. Topaz had lent us things to save us the shame of wearing our winter coats. There was a wonderful atmosphere of gentle age, a smell of flowers and beeswax, sweet yet faintly sour and musty, a smell that makes you feel very tender towards the past. We went into quite a little drawing room, where the Cottons were standing by the fireplace with two other people. Mrs. Cotton was talking up to the moment we were announced. Then she turned to us and was absolutely silent for a second. I think she was astonished at how Rose and Topaz looked. I noticed Simon looking at Rose. Then we were all shaking hands and being introduced to the others. They were a Mr. and Mrs. Fox Cotton, English relations of the Cottons. Rather distant ones, I think. As soon as I heard the husband called Aubrey, I remembered that he is an architect. I read something about his work in a magazine once. He is middle-aged, with a greyish face and thin, no-coloured hair. There is something very elegant about him, and he has a beautiful speaking voice, though it is a bit affected. I was next to him while we were drinking our cocktails. My first, and it tasted horrid. So I asked him about the architecture of the house. He launched forth at once. "What makes it so perfect," he said, "is that it's a miniature great house. It has everything. Great hall, long gallery, central courtyard, but it's on so small a scale that it's manageable even in these days. I've hankered for it for years. How I wish I could persuade Simon to let me have it on a long lease." He said it as much for Simon to hear as for me. Simon laughed and said, "Not on your life." Then Mr. Fox Cotton said, "Do tell me, the exquisite lady in grey. Surely she's the Topaz of McMorris's picture in the Tate Gallery." And after we had talked about Topaz for a minute or two, he drifted over to her. I had time to notice that Simon was admiring Rose's dress and that she was telling him about the crinoline, which seemed to fascinate him. He said he must go and see old Mrs. Stebbins. Then the vicar joined me and obligingly finished my cocktail for me. Soon after that, we went in to dinner. The table was a pool of candlelight, so bright that the rest of the room seemed almost black, with the faces of the family portraits floating in the darkness. Mrs. Cotton had Father on her right and the vicar on her left. Topaz was on Simon's right, Mrs. Fox Cotton on his left. Rose was between the vicar and Mr. Fox Cotton. I wished she could have been next to Simon, but I suppose married women have to be given precedence. I have an idea that Neil just may have asked for me to be next to him, because he told me I would be as we went in. It made me feel very warm towards him. It was a wonderful dinner, with real champagne. Lovely, rather like very good ginger ale without the ginger. But I wish I could have had that food when I wasn't at a party, because you can't notice food fully when you're being polite. And I was a little bit nervous. The knives and forks were so complicated, I never expected to feel ignorant about such things. We always had several courses for dinner at Aunt Millicent's, but I couldn't even recognise all the dishes. And it was no use trying to copy Neil because his table manners were quite strange to me. I fear he must have seen me staring at him once because he said, "Mother thinks I ought to eat in the English way. She and Simon have gotten into it, but I'm darned if I will."
I asked him to explain the difference. It appears that in America it is polite to cut up each mouthful, lay down the knife on your plate, change your fork from the left to the right hand, load it, eat the forkful, change the fork back to your left hand, and pick up the knife again. And you must take only one kind of food on the fork at a time. Never a nice, comfortable wodge of meat and vegetables together.
"But that takes so long," I said.
"No, it doesn't," said Neil.
"Anyway, it looks terrible to me the way you all hang on to your knives."
The idea of anything English people do looking terrible quite annoyed me, but I held my peace.
"Tell you another thing that's wrong over here," Neil went on, waving his fork slightly. "Look at the way everything's being handed to your stepmother first. Back home, it'd be handed to Mother."
"Don't you care to be polite to the guest?" I said. Dear me, what a superior little horror I must have sounded.
"But it is polite. It's a lot more considerate anyway, because the hostess can always show you what to do with the food. If you turn out your soup on your plate or take a whole one of anything, don't you see what I mean?"
I saw very clearly, and I did think it a wonderfully good idea.
"Well, perhaps I could get used to changing my fork from hand to hand," I said. And I had a go at it. I found it very difficult. The vicar was watching us across the table. "When this house was built, people used daggers and their fingers," he said, "and it'll probably last until the days when men dine off capsules."
"Fancy asking friends to come over for capsules," I said.
"Oh, the capsules will be taken in private," said Father. "By that time, eating will have become unmentionable. Pictures of food will be considered rare and curious, and only collected by rude old gentlemen."
Mrs. Foxcotton spoke to Neil then, and he turned to talk to her, so I got a chance to look round the table. Both Father and the vicar were listening to Mrs. Cotton. Aubrey Foxcotton was monopolising Topaz. For the moment, no one was talking to either Rose or Simon. I saw him look at her. She gave him a glance through her eyelashes, and though I know what Topaz means about it being old-fashioned, it was certainly a most fetching glance. Perhaps Rose has got into better practice now. Anyway, I could see that Simon wasn't being put off by it this time. He raised his glass and looked at her across it almost as if he were drinking a toast to her. His eyes looked rather handsome above the glass, and I suddenly had a hope that she could really fall in love with him, in spite of the beard. But heavens, I couldn't. She smiled, the faintest flicker of a smile, and then turned and spoke to the vicar. I thought to myself, she's learning. Because it would have been very obvious if she had looked at Simon any longer. I had a queer sort of feeling, watching them all and listening. Perhaps it was due to what Father had been saying a few minutes before. It suddenly seemed astonishing that people should meet especially to eat together, because food goes into the mouth and talk comes out, and if you watch people eating and talking, rarely watch them, it is a very peculiar sight. Hands so busy, forks going up and down, swallowings, words coming out between mouthfuls, jaws working like mad. The more you look at a dinner party, the odder it seems. All the candlelit faces, hands with dishes coming over shoulders, the owners of the hands moving round quietly, taking no part in the laughter and conversation. I pulled my mind off the table and stared into the dimness beyond. And then I gradually saw the servants as real people watching us, whispering instructions to each other, exchanging glances. I noticed a girl from God's End Village and gave her a tiny wink and wished I hadn't, because she let out a little snort of laughter and then looked in terror at the butler. The next minute my left ear heard something which made my blood run cold, an expression I've always looked down on, but I really did get a cold shiver between my shoulders. Mrs. Cotton was asking Father how long it was since he had published anything.
"A good 12 years, he said in the blank voice which our family accepts as the close of a conversation.
It had no such effect on Mrs. Cotton.
"You've thought it best to lie fallow," she said. "How few writers have the wisdom to do that."
Her tone was most understanding, almost reverent. Then she added briskly,
"But it's been long enough, don't you think?"
I saw Father's hand grip the table. For an awful second I thought he was going to push his chair back and walk out.
as he so often does at home if any of us annoy him. But he just said, very quietly, I've given up writing, Mrs. Cotton, and now let's talk of something interesting. But this is interesting, she said. I sneaked to look at her. She was very upright, all deep blue velvet and pearls. I don't think I ever saw a woman look quite so noticeably clean. And I warn you, I'm quite unsnubbable, Mr. Mortmain. When a writer so potentially great as you keeps silent so long, it's somebody's duty to find out the reason. Automatically, one's first guess is drink, but that's obviously not your trouble. There must be some psychological. Just then, Neil spoke to me. Quiet a minute, I whispered. But I missed the rest of Mrs. Cotton's speech. Father said, Good God, you can't say things like that to me at your own dinner table. Oh, I always employ shock tactics with men of genius, said Mrs. Cotton. And one has to employ them in public, or the men of genius bolt. I'm perfectly capable of bolting in public or out, said Father. But I could tell he wasn't going to. There was an easy, amused tone in his voice that I hadn't heard for years. He went on banteringly. Tell me, are you unique, or has the American clubwoman become more menacing since my day? It seemed to me a terribly rude thing to say, even in fun. But Mrs. Cotton didn't appear to mind in the least. She just said smilingly, I don't happen to be what you mean by a clubwoman. And anyway, I think we must cure you of this habit of generalizing about America on the strength of two short lecture tours. Serve Father right. He has always talked as if he had brought America home in his trouser pocket. Naturally, I wanted to go on listening. But I saw Mrs. Cotton notice me, so I turned quickly to Neil. All right now, I said. What was it? He asked. Did you think he'd broken a tooth? I laughed and told him what I'd been listening to. You just wait, he said. She'll have him turning out masterpieces 8 hours a day, unless, of course, he goes for her with a cake knife. I stared at him in amazement. He went on. Oh, she had our attorney send us all the details of the case. Made me laugh a lot, but I guess she was a bit disappointed that it wasn't a real attempt at murder. Can you understand how a ridiculous thing like that could put him off his work? I asked. Why, I don't even understand your father's work when he was on it, said Neil. I'm just not literary. After that, we talked of other things. I felt it would be polite to ask questions about America. He told me about his father's ranch in California, where he had lived until he joined Mrs. Cotton and Simon. It is strange to realize how little he has had to do with them. I said it seemed very sad that the father had died before he could inherit Scotney Hall. He wouldn't have lived in it anyway, said Neil. He'd never have settled down anywhere but in America, any more than I shall. I almost began to say, But your brother's going to live here, isn't he? But I stopped myself. Neil had sounded so cross that I felt it might be a sore subject. I asked him if he liked Rose's dress, mostly to change the conversation. He said, Not very much if you want the honest truth. It's too fussy for me. But she looks very pretty in it. Knows it too, doesn't she? There was a twinkle in his eye, which took off the rudeness, and I must admit that Rose was knowing it all over the place. The most wonderful frozen pudding came round then, and while Neil helped himself, I let my ear listen to Father and Mrs. Cotton again. They seemed to be getting on splendidly, though it did sound a bit like a shouting match. I saw Topaz look across anxiously, then look relieved. Father was chuckling. "Oh, talk to the vicar. Give me a rest," he said. "But I shall return to the attack," said Mrs. Cotton. Her eyes were sparkling, and she looked about twice as healthy as anyone normally does. "Well, how are you enjoying your first grown-up dinner party?" Father asked me. It was the first word he had spoken to me throughout the meal, but I could hardly blame him for that. He was rather flushed, and somehow larger than usual. There was a touch of the magnificence I still remember about him from pre-cake knife days. He had a slight return of it when he married Topaz, but it didn't last. The awful thought came to me that he might be going to fall in love with Mrs. Cotton. She was talking to him again within a couple of minutes. Soon after that, the females left the table. As we went upstairs, Topaz slipped her arm through mine.
Could you hear? She whispered. Is he really enjoying himself? Or was he just putting it on?
I told her I thought it was genuine.
It's wonderful to see him like that.